Jim, will you come forward? Who are you? I chose this guy because he's somebody who fuses, in my mind, the ability to, I mean, first of all, because he's a wonderful person. Secondly, because you fuse intellectual and policy worlds, because you're a practitioner. You are somebody who's been in the trenches, as you're going to see very shortly. We talk about the most salient of the issues of proliferation, whether it's North Korea or Iran, or what have you. This is a gentleman in front of you who's going to be a seer, one of our guides for this year, to give us insight, and it's insight of long, deep knowledge and understanding. That he has a sense of humor about this and optimism is one of the most important things that I can think of to try to impart in the first class. But as I was joking with you, don't take away the edge of this. This is still urgent and rosy out there, right?
Well, I hope so. That's what I do for a living, so.
There you are.
I don't want it to wrap it up too soon. But so first of all, let me say it's really a tremendous honor to be here. I really am happy to be here. And I know everyone says that when they come. But I can prove it this time. You know, when Sherm asked me to come and do this, the rational response would have been, no, I am too busy because I'm signing a book contract this week. It's the beginning of the semester. And the North Koreans and the Iranians seem to be in some personal rivalry to see who can suck away my time more. And they're both doing a really great job. So this was not the right choice for me to make to come here. But Sherm asked me. I did it for two reasons. Sherm asked me. And for some reason, every time he asks me, I can't say no. I always say yes. And I plan to seek counseling about that because I can't really explain it. And it's getting worse and worse. And then secondly, because you don't quite realize this yet, and you're probably a little intimidated. He can be intimidating in the beginning. You're probably intimidated by all this, but you will soon discover that you are a special group of people. And I'm assuming that because I've dealt with epic classes in the past, and they've gone on, individuals have gone on to do unbelievable things. And some have been interns for me. That's not what I mean by unbelievable things. But I mean by that I've had experience with them and seen them go off and have really, really interesting careers. And so even though it makes no sense for me, I am happy to be here and happy to talk to you for this first session. I think it's terrific that Sherm, and I wish more people would do it, asked the speaker to talk a little bit about themselves because, you know, biography is important. And we are people in addition to being scholars, and it's sort of interesting to see how people get where they are. So I have a couple of slides on that. That was from a poster. I did a speech out in LA, and I was stunned to see my head in a mushroom cloud. And I could only say I thought it was very, very disturbing. But hopefully, you know, if people saw more of that, they might give up nuclear weapons, I think. If you imagine that my head, a 50-story head of mine, would appear with it. But anyway, my focus in my work is nuclear weapons. Some terrorism on the side, but mostly nuclear weapons and nuclear weapon states. And I've been to Iran and North Korea, and I've spoken with officials in all these countries about their past nuclear weapons programs, about their future interest in nuclear weapons or nuclear technology in general. And I've testified before the Senate on these issues, on Iran, on nuclear terrorism, and this is getting cut off, and I've appeared on MTV. And that seems to be the thing that people really appreciate the most about me, is that I've been, although it was not the Hills or Jersey Shore, that's all I'm going to say. But that's sort of one thing, but let me talk more personally.
You have a question, Jim?
No, I already have a question.
I want to know what show it was.
It's really not that exciting. It was. They have a news program. They used to do like 5-minute clips of news, and they interviewed me for that.
Did you meet Sway?
No, they came to me, so I didn't really meet. You know, me. So I was a philosopher.
Inquiring minds want to know.
Yeah, I know. I put it out there. That's what I should expect. I started out as a philosophy major, and I still love philosophy and history. And I first got interested in the nuclear issue. I was a high school debater. The topic one year involved nuclear weapons. I sort of got into it. And then I went to college in the late 1970s. And then you were real concerned about the US and the Soviet Union annihilating each other was palpable. And then you had the freeze movement, a lot of protest in the 80s when President Reagan was elected and his talking about bombing the Soviet Union in 5 minutes and all that sort of thing. But anyway, I started out as a philosophy major. And then when I graduated from school, I became a community organizer. And I worked with low-income people and senior citizens for a while, and I ran for local office, and I worked on strikes, and, you know, I did different things, and I sort of divided my time between War and peace issues, and in particular the nuclear issue, and sort of domestic justice type things. And then I went to grad school, and once you're in grad school, you got to write a dissertation, and once you write a dissertation, you got to decide what you're going to do. You can't do everything. And my fields were, I had American politics as one field, and I had security studies as the other. I was at MIT. I got my PhD at MIT. And then, you know, the day came, which was I going to do? And this is the mid-1990s. By this point, the Cold War is over. No one cares about international security. It's the dot-com bubble, and everyone cares about making money, being an investment banker, whatever. But everyone thinks war is over. All this stuff is behind them, and they've forgotten it all. And I had to decide which I was going to do. So I, in my gut, the thing that really inspired me intellectually, the problems, the puzzles that I was trying to solve were on the security side. So I said, you know, screw it, I'm going to go ahead and do security anyway, even though it's a dying field. Even within academia, it was a dying field. So I decided this, you know, 1994, 1995, and at this point, no one can guess that, Iran has not built a centrifuge yet. North Korea's nuclear program was solved because there's an agreement, a treaty in place to get it resolved. And no one had heard of an obscure group called Al-Qaeda. So in 1995, that looked like a terrible career decision, a terrible career decision. But things really worked out quite differently than I would have expected. And it turned out that the stuff that I was interested in and working on, people cared about once again. And so just about me personally, I continue to like history and philosophy. I like arguments, not arguing, but arguments, interesting, good arguments. There is a real joy to intellectual discovery, whether it's coming up with a new idea or solving a puzzle or finding a document that no one's ever found before that proves that some country tried to add a secret nuclear weapons programs. These are all good days when you have those experiences as a scholar. Now, it can be a lonely profession because we're off working on our own, and not all scholars are the most social of people, and you're usually reading or sitting or writing alone. But it's been a great career for me. I've been to crazy places, and I've done a bunch of fun stuff. I've been in a movie, and I enjoy having control over my own schedule, and I enjoy getting to do what I think is important for me. And so my summary line here is, you know, to thine own self be true. And, you know, it worked for me. My lawyers tell me I need to add the caveat that if you are at heart a murderer, then I would act like someone else. You know? But accepting that, to thine own self be true. All right, let's get on with the business here. All right, I'm going to talk about three things. That's what you're going to look like by the time I'm done, there on the right-hand side. And if you do fall asleep, I will give you the claw. It's painful. We're going to talk about nuclear myths, nuclear puzzles, and the challenges ahead. You know, and the myths are important. Sherms, you're going to get the sense of this real quickly. I got into this business because I care about the possibility that nuclear weapons would be used again. People forget it was already used again, and that millions of people could be killed. So I don't take this lightly, and I've devoted a good chunk of my life on this issue. But I think what happens is we talk about it, and it's so depressing, right? You know, who wants to think about this, and all you want to do is pack it in a box and push it away, and it actually takes away your ability to feel the enthusiasm and the energy you need to work on problems like this. So it's actually counterproductive. But it also turns out that in the scholarly world, the world of truth, that a lot of what we think about nuclear weapons is a myth. And then actually, there's a ton of good news here. There's a remarkable record of accomplishment. So that's what we're going to talk about. All right, proliferation myths. And I have a whole bunch of them, but we only have time to talk about two of them. One, proliferation is inevitable. There's nothing we can do about it. Once they discovered you could split the atom, you know, Russia got the bomb, we got the bomb, and then Russia got the bomb, and on, and you can read, if you read newspapers from 1945, 1955, 1965, all the way up to 2005, you would read plenty of pronouncements that say, nuclear weapons are going to spread, there's nothing we can do about it. It is inevitable. It's like going from, you know, the stick to the gun to the airplane. There's nothing that we can do about it. And, by the way, not only is it inevitable, but the real danger here are those crazy rogue states. Because the other states, you know, they're regular states, and maybe they can handle it a little better. But the rogue states, they cannot handle their nuclear weapons. They cannot handle their liquor. And there's going to be a problem. That's where the real danger is. Well, I think both these things are dead wrong. Can I get a glass of water or a cup of water, sir?
Heavy water. There you go. All right. Hello. Very good. All right. And I'll try to stick some facts in along the way too here. So, you know, here are the states that have nuclear weapons. The U.S. got it, and then the Russians followed suit, and the British got it, and the French got it. And when, after the, you know, once the U.S. and the Soviets got it, the Chinese, they didn't want to be left out. And then the Israelis got it, and the Indians. South Africa got nuclear weapons, then gave them up. Pakistan, North Korea. And if you plot that on a graph, yeah.
I guess 10-second response. Why did South Africa seek nukes again?
Why don't I deal with that in question and answer? Can I do that? And that'll be the first question and answer. In fact, probably the most efficient thing for me to do is race through this material and then do the Q&A at the end. That's just more of my stuff. So, you know, if you plot that on a graph, what does it look like? It looks like proliferation is inevitable. It's a line that, sure, it moderates there at the end. Notice that it flattens out. But it's a chain, and chains keep giving, you know, and it just goes on and on and on. Well, that's if you simply plot the number of states that have gotten nuclear weapons over time. But if you plot the rate of proliferation, the number of new nuclear weapon states per decade, then the rate has gone down. You would never guess that reading the newspaper, that the rate of proliferation has declined over time. It hit its peak in the 1960s when China, Israel, and France joined the weapons club. Since the 1960s, the number of new entries into the club, new nuclear weapon states, has gone down. And as important, there are fewer states seeking nuclear weapons today than at virtually any decade in the past. In other words, the pool, not only is the absolute number, but the rate gone down, the pool of potential candidates has shrunk. In the 40s, 50s, and 60s, in the 50s and 60s, everyone was thinking about having a nuclear weapon. Now the number of states that think they might want to get in that game is actually quite small. So does that mean we don't face any additional problems in the future? Does this mean, is this irreversible? No. Things could change for the worse. There could be events that lead people to rethink their decisions, and we can talk about that. But it's important to at least start out with an empirically correct understanding of what the past has really wrought and what the record of the past is. And the record is the rate of proliferation has declined over time. In fact, here's a list of the countries that's had an interest in nuclear weapons, started down that path, and then stopped and reversed course. 75% of the countries that had an interest in it stopped and reversed course. You could call this the non-nuclear age, because the non-nuclear countries who considered it and didn't, they outnumber the nuclear weapon states, you know, 3-1. So all these, you know, and some of them are rather surprising. And then, you know, because I'm a collector, you know, I keep tabs on these states down here. I don't have good evidence on these, but I suspect that Spain and Chile, and I still think Holland, might have had a nuclear weapons program. But that's, you know, that's what scholars do. They go look for new cases. So it may be that box is too small. It may be even bigger. Again, can I take questions at the end?
Just remember Syria.
Yeah. All right. Let's talk about acquisition versus renunciation since the 1990s. Right, again, what does this picture look like? Well, since the 1990s, South Africa gave up the bomb. Ukraine, Kazakhstan, and Belarus inherited the nuclear assets from the collapsing Soviet Union. Ukraine, in particular, had usable nuclear weapons-related assets, and yet they all gave up what they had and joined the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty as non-weapon states. And the DPRK is on both sides here, because the DPRK is the only nuclear weapon state to have said that it absolutely plans to give up its nuclear weapons in no uncertain terms. And they've said it recently. Now, of course, they also acquired nuclear weapons, and we go back and forth and back and forth here. So they qualify for both lists, but I haven't written off the DPRK. That's North Korea, Democratic People's Republic of Korea, DPRK. I have not written off North Korea as a country that is going to forever be a nuclear weapon state. My own guess is that over time that will not be the case, and that they will rejoin that list. We'll talk more about them in a minute. So, in summary, at least on the myths, this first myth, Proliferation is not inevitable. The rate of proliferation has declined. 3 out of 4 countries that started down that path stopped and reversed course. The rate of renunciation has been higher than the rate of acquisition since the 1990s. And even our language, the way we talk about the thing, we say those countries that want nuclear weapons, they're rogue states, they're outliers, they're outside the mainstream. They didn't talk that way about in the 50s and the 60s because people expected nuclear weapons to spread. They expected lots of countries to have them. We don't, or we think it's roguish or unusual too, and that's even reflected in our language. All right, myth two. Rogue proliferators are the number one nuclear threat. And that's why we should spend 90% of our policy on efforts and hours and discussions and media time on those that might get the bomb. Well, if you don't have, you can't use a nuclear weapon if you don't have one. So potential proliferators, they don't have a weapon, right? They're wanting to get a weapon. But the other countries that are members of the Nuclear Weapons Club, they have the weapons, you know, and you can't use them unless you have them. So I think it's a mistake, while it's wise to be somewhat focused and allocate some share of energy and effort to trying to prevent more states from having nuclear weapons, it would be a mistake to do that at the exclusion of remembering the countries that already have the nuclear weapons because they're the ones that could use them. So India and Pakistan, I think that is, you know, a very dangerous situation. India and Pakistan is not the U.S. Soviet Union, separated by half a planet you know, a lot of other things. India and Pakistan smack against each other, you know, tough politics inside both states. Pakistan, you could argue, is on the verge of becoming a failed state. I don't want to get into that right now, but there's no doubt that Pakistan has a lot of issues. And India is not help. It has traditionally not helped in this regard. You know, it's sort of poked Pakistan. Israel nearly used, at least according to some reports, Israel would have used nuclear weapons at the beginning of the 73 war, that it rolled planes out on the tarmac. Now, did they do that for signaling? Were they real? They thought they were losing that war in the first 2 days. And so I think it's at least reasonable to consider that they considered using nuclear weapons. Also, let's think about Saddam Hussein for a minute. We'll play a little hypothetical thing. So Saddam Hussein, in the first Iraq war, he sends Scuds. He shoots Scud missiles, right? He withdraws from Kuwait. Then we have what is the beginning of the second war against Iraq, in which he's actually deposed. Now, and at the time, everyone thought that he had chem and biological warheads, and he had the Scuds. You know, that was the working presumption. And so you're Saddam Hussein. Let's say you have working chem and bio Scuds, Scuds with warheads, and you know you're going down. You know, you're going to get killed. And you say to yourself, well, fine, I'm going to take some with me, and I'll go down as the greatest Arab leader in the world. I'm going to fire these Scuds into Israel. I fired Scuds into Israel last time that were conventional. Why not fire, if I'm going down anyway, why not fire Scuds again into Israel, but this time with chem and bioweapons? Because I got nothing to lose. It's use them or lose them. Had he done that, I think that there was a non-trivial probability that Israel would have responded with tactical nuclear weapons. Israel has a military doctrine of disproportionate punishment because they feel they're small and they have a military that's based on citizen participation. So if they get hit, they feel that they have to hit 3 times harder to deter others from doing the same. And for a country to have crossed the chem-bio threshold, that is to say the WMD threshold, they would have wanted to send a strong signal that they were not going to tolerate that. Now, I could get no one to talk about this in the U.S. in the run-up to the second Iraq war. No one would listen to me. I tried conversations literally around with colleagues around the table, and they changed the subject. Now, you know, not on purpose, but people just wouldn't look at this. But when I talked to my Israeli friends in the security studies world, as one of them said, well, not 90%, not 10%. So in other words, there is a more than 10% chance that that's actually that we would have had a use of nuclear weapons in the Middle East. So, yes, are rogue nations a danger? Yes. But it's as much, if not more, of a danger if you already possess them, because then you can use them. And, you know, that goes for the U.S. and North Korea, too. People forget. We often talk about it. We use the nuclear weapons. In the U.S., we often talk about it as if they were never used. But we did, and we were the ones who used them. So I think we need to have a more diversified sense of what the nature of the threat is. Yes, rogue nations, and I don't like the term rogue. Yes, additional countries acquiring nuclear weapons is an unwanted outcome, and we should try very hard to prevent that. But we should also keep our eye on the ball, and the ball is the countries that have nuclear weapons. All right, nuclear puzzles. Puzzle one, why are there so few nuclear weapon states? Everyone predicted, going back to the first myth, that these weapons would spread. One would lead to two would lead to four would lead to 16. Everyone would get them. There's even a Tom Lehrer song about this, that how everyone is going to end up with a nuclear weapon. So what in God's name happened? Well, was it the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty? Remember that chart I showed you of the rate of proliferation, and it peaked in the 60s and it began to decline subsequently after the 1960s? Well, what happened in the 1970s? Well, one of the things that happened in the 1970s was the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Now, you know, people are pretty skeptical, understandably skeptical about that explanation. Well, you know, the lawyers like to say it's the force of law that forces countries to do stuff. Only the lawyers say that. You know, no one else believes it, but the lawyers believe it. And then some scholars say, well, treaties embed norms and it changes the way people think about stuff. That actually is an explanation that doesn't fare very well when you peel it back. I don't have time to get into it, but I can talk about it in the Q&A. And the people who don't think treaties work, you know, they say, give me a break. These are pieces of paper. And traditionally, treaties with respect to security issues have been weaker than treaties on trade or business or other sorts of issues. And the NPT, it has no enforcement mechanism. You can withdraw. You can build a fuel cycle and get to the edge of a bomb and still be in the treaty. That's what we're dealing with Iran right now. So, you know, how could it be the NPT? And I think, and this is a product of my scholarship, what I do is I study countries that start down the path towards nuclear weapons and reverse course. I write their histories, and then I disaggregate their histories into individual decision sequences. So for Egypt, I looked at Egypt. You know, there are like 50 or 60 decision sequences where there's a proposal and a result and then an action, and some of them favor nuclear weapons and some of them favor renunciation. And then I try to explain, by looking at theories, try to evaluate, well, what caused them to make those decisions? You know, was it security issues? Was it norms? Was it a treaty? What was going on here? So I don't think the NPT is the whole story. I think there are many stories in the nuclear age, but it would be a mistake to think that the NPT is just a piece of paper. And what its impact was not what you would think. It's not norms. It's not the force of law. What it did was it reshaped the issue. Prior to the NPT, you want to have a bomb program, you want to talk to your defense minister about having a bomb program, you did it. You didn't have to tell anyone about it. No one had to know about it. NPT draws a line in the sand. You have to either join this treaty or not join this treaty. You have to commit to what you're going to do. And if you decide not to join the treaty, other people will see that you have not joined the treaty. So what was once a private matter is now a public matter. Secondly, it reframed the debate, and I think this is probably the most important one. It reframed the debate and determined who got to play. Prior to NPT, a bomb decision is a decision between your defense minister and your prime minister. They can meet by themselves. Maybe the science guy sits in, you know, the head of the nuclear, civilian nuclear program. But it's essentially three people that are deciding this. But, and what is it, by the way? It's a defense decision. The decision to have a bomb is a defense decision made by a very small group of people. After the NPT, the country has to decide, are we going to join the treaty or not? Well, suddenly, that's not a defense decision, that's a foreign policy decision. And different people get to sit at the table. The Treasury gets to sit at the table. The Foreign Ministry gets to sit at the table. This thing that you could have carried on in the secrets, you know, in secret dark corners, is now exposed not only to the broader world, but to others within your own government who may have problems with that decision. So it changed the framing from defense decision to foreign policy decision, and it changed who got a vote at the table. It created political winners and losers. And if you lost, it raised the bar. If you had a vote, we're going to join the treaty. You know, you were one of three guys who were in favor of keeping a bomb program, staying out of the treaty. But once that decision's rendered and you join the treaty, yeah, you can come back and fight another day, but it's a lot harder. You're now facing multiple barriers because now you'll be violating a treaty commitment. Other people within the government are going to find out about it. It's a resolved decision. Governments, for the most part, they like to have resolved decisions and moved on. To go back and reopen something, much more difficult for the pro-bomb policy entrepreneur to do. And the treaty is dynamic, asymmetric, and enmeshing. It is dynamic. It's the articles of the treaty have not changed, but its implementation has changed. We have now gone through four or five iterations of safeguards, the implementing part of it. You know, what you have to do to be a member in good stead in the NPT, that has changed over time, and it's grown more and more intrusive. And, you know, the degree to which you open yourself up is more and more. It's asymmetric and it's enmeshing. Once in, again, it's you can't go backwards. And what once you've signed on to one set of agreements on your safeguards, then they come up with a new tougher one. Normally what happens is there's a crisis somewhere. India detonates a bomb in 74. We discover that Saddam had stuff after the first Gulf War. Everyone freaks out, so they pass a new, more stringent set of safeguard arrangements. Well, you joined the last three, and now there's the fourth one sitting before you. And, you know, it's hard not to, once you've joined the first three, say, oh, no, I'm not going to do this one. So you are being pulled like a Venus flytrap further down into a system where it's hard to get out of, to change your posture, reverse course, and become a new nuclear weapon state. Now, some states still do this, and I think there's a pattern with respect to authoritarian states, that they're more willing to break the rules than others, and we can talk, because I think they don't have a lot of these internal political features that I've talked about, but I don't have time to go into it. But I just want to give you an illustration of at least part of an explanation for why we have had this good success. And there are other parts of it too, but it would be a mistake to underestimate the treaty. Actually, some treaties do matter. Policy lessons. Well, those are some of the states that might consider getting nuclear weapons in the future. So how should we think about the problem? Well, we should reject the inevitability fallacy. What happens with the proliferation thing is, in the policy world and psychologically, we have panic followed by resignation. Oh my God, Iran's just about to get the bomb. India's about to get the bomb. Oh no, no, we gotta stop it. And then when that country crosses that threshold, we give up and say, oh well, there's nothing we can do about it. And I think that gets it exactly wrong. We should not be panicking, and there's still hope after a country crosses that threshold to get them to walk back down the ladder. That's what the story of South Africa. So a little less panic, you know, a little more even balance here, and I don't see any reason for resignation to like just give up on the issue. I do not think we should give up on India and Pakistan being nuclear weapon states. I do not believe that it is axiomatic that they will forever have their nuclear weapons. And I think by resigning, we're actually contributing to a bad outcome. We should not resign to that. We need to recognize success. We need to recognize its causes and build on that. And that's what my sort of scholarly work has been, is recognizing that success and then trying to explain why we have been successful so that we can build on success. We need to pay attention as much to domestic politics as to technical capability. All the, you know, 90% of the conversations about proliferation is how many centrifuges do you have? How big is your nuclear program? Do you have a reactor? I think the internal policy politics, the bureaucratic politics, is really the center of gravity here. And that's what we should be looking at. A little less on bean counting and a little more on the political dynamics internal to the state. And finally, we need to realize that nuclear weapons states pose an equal, if not greater, danger than the countries that want to have nuclear weapons. And we need to do something about that. All right, I have two more slides and I'm done. Bonus features. Just for the sake of question and answer, I've been to North Korea. I'm actively working on the North Korean issue now. I was at a track two with North Koreans in Sweden back in May. So a little North Korea 101. You know, this is the boogeyman. This is the evil country that's out to get us. And they have 26 million people. We have 300 million people. They have 26 million people, and they're the size of Mississippi. They spend $5 billion on their military. We spend $600 billion on our military. Five versus $600 billion. Their GDP is $26 billion. Ours is $14 trillion. So this is a weak state. I should mention I hosted a delegation from North Korea there with my kids. We were all having dinner. And that was part of my Christmas present to my kids that year. I told them they were each getting their own FBI file. Yeah. So I think North Korea is a weak state that is essentially as a policy of bargaining in crisis, provoking crisis in order to bargain and improve its position. It wants to engage the outside world, but it fears to death that once it opens up even a little bit, they'll lose power and they'll collapse. So they're stuck between a rock and a hard place. They are screwed. And on top of, you know, as if that wasn't bad enough, their dynastic slash theistic slash political leader, Kim Jong-il, remember this is a communist state, but where powers pass on from father to son? That breaks a few categories. He's dying. He's going to be dead within the year. There's only been one other transition from his father to him, and they took 20 years to groom Kim Jong-il to take over for his father. So he's now tapped the youngest kid, who's in his 20s, and this could be a very rough patch. This could be a singular time in North Korea and in East Asian security relations. So I'll just mention that, and then we can talk more about what that means in question and answer. Whoops. Iran. There's me with the president of Iran. I don't show that picture to many people because I don't want to get in a lot of trouble, but you get to see it. And I don't want to see any flashes going up from iPhones. All right, again, they have 66 million people. We have 300 million. They're the size of Alaska. Alaska is a big state, so that's, you know, it's big. But it's not the United States. Their military budget, $8 billion, ours, $600 billion. Their GDP, $127 billion, ours, $14 trillion. So, you know, our economy is 14, 15 times the size of Iran. I don't think Iran has made a command. With this, I'm in agreement with the intelligence community and their public statements. The consensus view, contrary to how people talk about it on TV, is that Iran has not yet made a decision to acquire a nuclear weapon. What they've decided to do is to try to acquire a capability so that if they want a nuclear weapon later on, then they can get in that game. Well, that sounds like the same thing, right? Having a capability, having a weapon. Well, it is not the same thing. Empirically, it is not the same thing. The countries that end up, in general terms, that list I showed you of the countries that got nuclear weapons, those are countries that said, I want it, I'm going to get it, it's my top priority, I'm going to do it now. And the ones who say, yeah, I like it, I want to keep it open as an option, let's see what we can do, those are the ones that start down that path and then end up not going anywhere. Now, will that happen with Iran? I don't know. But I'm just saying, by way of illustration, that there's a big difference between a capability decision and a weapons decision. And we shouldn't confuse the two. Now, unfortunately, as with North Korea, Iran is also going through an intense political internal transition. Following the June 12th election in 2009, the heavily disputed election, they are a divided government. And the division is not between the Greens and the principalists. The division is within the principalists. It's Ahmadinejad versus other sets of conservatives. And under those sorts of conditions, you know, it's very hard to know what's going to happen next. And I think there are incentives for them to want to settle up this issue, to get it behind them. And I think actually Ahmadinejad is the voice of that in the Iranian government right now, ironically. But there are going to be other incentives following this sort of ongoing dispute internally that would favor acquisition of nuclear weapons. So I think both with Iran and North Korea, we are in very uncertain territory, unfortunately. Leadership change is not a good thing to go through under any circumstances, except for elections. But it's really bad in these two political contexts where there's so much else going on and where struggles for power internally can create perverse incentives. But in both cases, what they do share is neither wants to end up in a shooting war with the U.S. or anyone else in the region. North Korea, the shocker here is that North Korea, their main goal, having normalized relations with the U.S. I know you would never guess that by the way they act, but that is in fact their goal. And they're going about it in a very unusual way, but that is what they want. They don't want to start a war. They will lose a war. They actually want to have normalized relations. Similarly for Iran, it's more divided, I think. But there's something, they're of two feelings. The U.S. is both the symbol of everything they detest, and in some ways they've built their identity on the fact that they're not the U.S., this imperial power that screwed with their elections in 53 and blah, 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 blah. But on the other hand, there's some deep part of them that wants to have relationship with the U.S. and be recognized as the leader, the dominant power in their region. Both countries are very status-oriented, like we're very status-oriented, but even more so. So, but they don't want a shooting war because, well, number one, they'll lose, and they'll lose quickly. And two, if there's any shooting war, then that's the green light for everyone to go after all those nuclear sites. So if there are going to be rocks thrown, they're not going to throw the first rock. Someone will throw a rock against them, and then they'll respond. But they're not going to throw the first rock because things get worse for them very, very quickly. So I think that's it. I think I stayed within my allotted time. That's a picture from North Korea, one of my favorite pictures from my trip. And I will stop there and entertain questions. And I believe someone's already in the queue because I said they were asking a question, and then I slammed them down and said, wait to the end. Was that you? Was that?
Yeah, I was going to ask.
Could you identify yourself? One of the norms in this class is, until we get to know each other thereafter, especially since we want to create a relationship with our friends, is for you to say your name. My name is, and then let's see how long it takes us to learn that.
All right, my name is Joel, from DC area.
Hi, Joel.
Well done.
Way to go, Logan.
The question I raised during your presentation was why South Africa wanted to acquire nukes, but I kind of have a different one now, but...
Okay.
Yeah, I guess you probably have time here, so yeah, I'll go with the first one.
Why okay, and just South so you know, my rule about a question and answer, so this is what I would prefer to be the how we handle this. I prefer that everyone gets one question until everyone's had a chance to ask a question, and then we can go around for round two, and I would prefer to alternate male-female. And I'll wait, and I'll wait until I get, if one side is not stepping up to the plate, I will wait. And then I pull out the claw. So what's your question? I don't know if we're going to get a second one back at you.
One of the big issues which is thrown around with Iran, North Korea, nuclear acquisition is that those nukes will fall into the wrong hands. But I mean, personally, I don't see that as much of a big of an issue because if either nation acquires such a valuable thing, they're not exactly going to give it up to untrustworthy hands. So do you see like terrorists acquiring an Iranian or North Korean nuclear weapon as much of an issue?
Well, I would answer it two ways. I think nuclear material security and weapon security is important. And so what I worry about is a North Korean collapse. That's what I worry about. I don't worry about North Korea giving nuclear weapons to non-state actors. In fact, we had a lot more time, then I would have gone through some of the other myths, and I think this is one of the myths. Rogues will give nuclear weapons to terrorists. Mm-hmm. So historically, it has been untrue. There is not a single recorded case of a nation state giving chem, biological, or nuclear weapons to a non-state actor. And of course, right? Because they don't want them, think about Black September in 1970 and the Palestinians in Syria. I'm a state. I don't really like non-state actors, but I'll use them for my own ends when I want to and it's convenient. And then, and I'll use them to go hassle some other a second state. But once that second state and I, we settle up whatever issues we have, well, it was great working with you. Best of luck to you, non-state actor. All right, there are, when states do stuff, if they're going to do military stuff, they just as soon do it with their own military over which they have control. They're not going to give the crown jewels, their chem, bio, and nuclear weapons to a crazy set of non-state actors over which they have no control, and that thing could end up back on their doorstep. So there are strong power reasons why states do not transfer these things, and they keep them in-house, and they handle them in-house. But it is possible that it could happen. And so there are three scenarios that I can imagine. One is they're forced into it. Imagine that Afghanistan and Pakistan switched places on the map. And Afghanistan, for whatever reasons, was the one that had the nuclear weapons. Well, as the Taliban starts to go down and they lose that operational institutional capacity to, retaliate with a nuclear weapon against if they're attacked, one can imagine that they might, farm that out or subcontract that out to someone else. But I think that's in some ways, there's a reason why that never happens. The super weak states, Pakistan excepted, the super weak states tend not to have the infrastructure and wherewithal to be building nuclear weapons. But it's a possibility. In other words, you sort of force them into. You put them in a position where they have to do something or they're dead. The second one, state takeover. You know, maybe a nation state that has nuclear weapons is taken over by a fringe group. That's a possibility. Again, though, state suicide, not that common in world history, you know, where states take actions that they know are going to result in their fundamental destruction. It just doesn't happen that often. Gray markets, again, Pakistan. So you have a state apparatus that has a network of acquiring stuff illicitly, clandestinely, to help with its own nuclear program. And then other incentives start to take over where they see have reason for economics or whatever. The secret, again, secrecy, 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 secrecy. The secret group who's been running this stuff on the side, clandestinely, illegally. Well, who are they going to meet at parties? You know, they're going to meet other people involved in clandestine, illicit, secret stuff. And so you can imagine gray markets that maybe they think, oh, well, you know, we have these parts. They're 20 years old. They don't matter. You know, we're not giving them the good stuff. We're just getting this other crap off our hands that we don't need anymore. So you worry about, it's not the black market, it's the gray market where a state is an actor in a clandestine market with respect to nuclear stuff. Again, I still think it's implausible. The most direct route is that a state collapses. And then the question is, because, you know, this is the thing that drove the Iraq war, right? We had to topple Saddam because he was going to give nuclear weapons to terrorists. That's the summary argument. And there would, in the words of President Bush, be mushroom clouds on the horizon. So how do you prevent that? Well, you know, one thing you can do is go and attack every country that might have an interest in nuclear weapons. And if you go look at that list of the 75% that gave it up, we're going to be busy for a really long time. A more direct route, if this is what you are concerned about, it seems to me, is to lock down the material, to shrink the size of the material, to secure the material, rather than trying to topple every government that might have the aspiration to get involved in the nuclear business. So that's my take on that. Next up. Yes, ma'am.
What are some reasons that a state...
Your name is...
I'm Ellie Capel on the phone. What are some reasons that a state would pursue nuclear capabilities and not go through with actually creating...
Yep. You know, I have slides on that too, but I won't call them up. I'm done. Well, states can have lots of motivations for wanting nuclear weapons. We traditionally think of it as purely a security thing. You know, I feel threatened. Either the country I don't like has nuclear weapons, or they have an overwhelming conventional force. You know, this is what Pakistan faced. They faced overwhelming conventional force from India. So one way to sort of counterbalance that is to have a nuclear weapon. That has dominated academic thinking about nuclear weapons for eons, since the 40s. And I think, yes, there are security. There's some states' behavior can be much better explained by, in terms of security variables, but some it doesn't explain anything at all, and oftentimes, you know, it's a mix, and it's not the most important mix. There are also identity issues. I want to be treated as I'm the Rodney Dangerfield. Iran is the Rodney Dangerfield of Southwest Asia. They feel like they don't get any respect. They think they're better than the Arabs. They're better than the Turks, and they should be treated accordingly. And so there's, you know, and status is an issue. And, you know, when you look at the, who are the permanent five members of the UN Security Council, they're all nuclear weapon states. So I think status can be a thing. The one I pay a lot of attention to is bureaucratic politics, internal bureaucratic politics. Who benefits from this project? You know, this is like any other military project or any other spending project. And what I find is air forces are always out there pushing this, you know. We need to get an atomic bomb. We need to be there. And why? Because in the early days, you don't have rockets. You don't build a rocket that can carry a bomb until way late in the trajectory. So what do you rely on? You rely on airplanes. And so if you get a bomb, the Air Force is going to get a brand new fleet. And I know that sounds crude, but that's the God's honest truth. That's where you see, in terms of these things don't happen magically. There's a policy process. There has to be a champion, a policy entrepreneur, and a champion who's going to keep pushing this through leadership changes and through different, you know, distractions. And the Air Force and the Atomic Energy Authority are two core constituencies, historically, for pushing weapons programs. You know, and that was true in Saddam's case, where the nuclear authority was sort of dying on the vine and they were shopping for a project to keep them alive. And he made some inquiry about it. He said, yeah, we can do that, we can do that. So, and that was true in Australia. And there's also a status thing. Let me circle back to status. It's not just status, nation state to nation state. But I saw this in a couple of cases. It's military to military status. If I'm in the officers' club and I'm with my American colleagues, then I'm in a lower status. And if there are operational plans being made, you know, we treat the British and the French differently than we treat the Dutch or someone else, in part because they're nuclear weapon states. And the military people, some of them anyway, feel that. And there's a status issue there. So you've got status issues, you've got bureaucratic politics, you know, traditional bureaucratic politics, pork politics. You've got threat variables. You know, I'm sure I'm leaving a couple out. If I had my slide, I could go through all of them. But there's that. Then why do they go away? You know, you have change. Part of it is external shocks. You have there's an earthquake. There's a war, conventional war. There's something that happened that draws your attention away from things, and the dream drifts away. There are changes in leadership, a change in defense minister, a change in president or prime minister, a change in the head of the nuclear program. Those things matter. You know, they can kill a program. That's why the NPT is, I think, is so important, is because in the past, they might kill a program, you know, new prime minister comes in and says, come on, forget about that. But then they just, the entrepreneurs, pro-nuclear entrepreneurs, they just wait the guy out. They wait for him to go away, and they wait for their guy to come in, and then they start up again. But once you have the NPT, not so easy. So why do they give them up? You know, part of it is, they get you have internal changes of leadership. Part of it is the NPT. I described that whole process of having been a constraint on weapons decisions and the transparency that that produces. You don't have the luxury of doing it in the dark anymore. Sometimes economic stuff. There's some argument to be made that Ukraine and some of the other states of the former Soviet Union may have considered giving up their nuclear weapons because they want to be part of the new global economic scene, and if they didn't, they weren't going to be able to get a foot in the door. If they looked like they were going to be nuclear weapon states, then they weren't going to do it. Same thing with Libya. You could argue that Libya gave up its stuff because it was just too costly over time. So those are some. There are a variety of reasons. And different people, you know, that's what scholars do. So we all pick our favorites and talk about that as if it's the most important one. And me, I'm a domestic politics guy, an internal bureaucratic politics guy. Yes, sir.
I'm Daniel Lincoln. I'm a senior. And my question is just going off that picture of you with Ahmadinejad, I'm just curious, what was the purpose of your visit? Like, when were you there? Who did you see?
I've gone there like 5 or 6 times, but that's from a dinner. And I'm having dinner next week with them, because every September they open up the UN General Assembly. Right? All the leaders come through town. He didn't do it his first year, but this is now the 6th year he's done it. He has a meeting with religious figures, and he has a meeting with scholars. And we have dinner for 3 hours. And there, you know, first year there were 12 of us. This year I think there'll probably be 30 of us. And it's also been more mixed. There used to be only scholars, and now it's scholars and NGO types too. And, you know, the format of it is, you know, we're seated around a huge table, and we're having dinner, and then each person who's the guest gets to ask a question. We ask all our questions serially in a row, and then he takes all the questions and answers each one of them as a block at the end, after the last questioner. And he gets asked about the Holocaust. You know, he asks about all the stuff. All the people in the room are asked about the stuff that you think they would ask about, you know. Do you think Israel should be wiped off the map? Do you have nuclear weapons? What about the students and the disputed election? You know, he gets asked those questions. And so I've logged now with him, you know, 13 or 14 hours just watching him, observing him answer questions. And he's an unusual figure. He's an unusual politician. He's not a glad hander. You know, he's not Ted Kennedy. You know, he's not out there, puts his arm around you, asks how your kids are doing. You know, someone you can easily sit down and have a beer with. He is, you know, in Iran they have near beer. And when you stay in the hotels, or I stay at a foreign minister guest house, they have this thing that in a beer can that looks like beer, but it's non-alcoholic. It tastes mildly of apple juice. In any case, he was a political innovator. He was every president before him was a clerk, and it was considered beneath them to travel to the provinces to campaign. Well, he went to the provinces and campaigned, and they had their first ever political debate for the 2009 the 2009 presidential election, and he treated it like an American political debate where he went after the other guys. You know, it was the other guys were you know, going to be stately and formal, and he let into them, you know, and held pieces of paper with writings on them and all that sort of stuff. So he is a political innovator. I don't know, I was talking with Ina earlier. For me, the fundamental thing, and I've seen different Ahmadinejads each time. I've seen the professorial Ahmadinejad, the angry Ahmadinejad. But the thing that I've not resolved in my mind is, does he believe what he says? You know, because sometimes he comes off as naive. And I mean that descriptively, not pejoratively, as someone who is an idealist. And that can be a very dangerous thing. I'm an idealist, but I don't think I'm a dangerous person. But I remember being asked in this first dinner with him, someone asked the question, you know, this is a softball question. President Ahmadinejad, don't you think when carrying out your foreign policy, it's the first priority is to attend to Iranian national interest? You know, what could be easier than that question? Yes, next question. His answer was not yes, next question. His answer was, well, when you walk, you can't look only on the ground, you have to look up at the stars, blah, 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 blah. As if to say, no, it's not the most important thing. So I found that a little unsettling. But I've talked to Iranians who think he is, he says all this stuff and it doesn't mean it, and he's really a cutthroat guy, politically speaking. He's you got to give him credit, because he is a survivor and a, you know, all the other presidents would bow down to the Supreme Leader. Oh, Supreme Leader, you're the guy. And the Supreme Leader is the guy. The Supreme Leader is the president. The president is not the president. The Supreme Leader is the president. But Ahmadinejad continues to take these risks and push back and try to go around the Supreme Leader. And that's why there's this giant division within the principles camp between the pro-Ahmadinejad people and the anti-Ahmadinejad people. And I think Ahmadinejad is a little bit of one of the guys I know who went to school with him says he's a risk taker. And I'm guessing that's right. And that can be a good thing and that can be a bad thing. So that's my riff on him. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Emily. My question goes back to the one before, the one you just answered a little bit. And so you were saying the reasons that the states, the ones that did decide to sort of drop off of their nuclear programs, did. But my question is, the countries that were initially, just for the most part on your chart, were the ones that sort of got into it when nuclear weapons were first sort of created and first sort of started becoming a hot topic.
Yeah.
So sort of like jumping on the bandwagon.
Yep.
So my question is, now that that fervor has died off and
yep.
a whole new sort of influx of money in different countries and like countries that weren't even really on the map at that
yep,
time.
Yep.
And now they have money, now they have infrastructure, and they have, I mean, partially sort of greed and a desire to sort of be noticed and be taken seriously, especially by the United States, but
uh-huh.
really just by all first world countries.
Yep.
Do you think that they not necessarily in regards to the NPT, but do you think that now that they have this money and this sort of desire and the infrastructure, do you think that they're going to start becoming presences and becoming going on to that list of people who are trying to not necessarily just have the capabilities to actually have the...
Well, I think that's a great question, and it's a great observation to see that there is some periodization here, you know, on the cases, that a lot of the earliest cases are, you know, Europeans and Canada and countries that wanted to get into the game. Not all. It doesn't completely hold that way, but there is some flavor to that. And so I think it is something to watch for, but I want to see some hard evidence first, because the overwhelming experience that I observe historically is states do a lot of talking, and then there's no follow-up. Oh, we're going to have 20 power plants. We're going to have 10 power plants. I mean, Egypt announced it was going to have 10 power plants, you know, 10 different times, and nothing ever came of it. And of course, they're operating in it was a wide open environment in the 50s and 60s, and the environment they have to operate in now is much more constrained. And it's not about having a nuclear program. To have a nuclear weapon, you need to have one or of two things that don't exist in nature. You need either highly enriched uranium or plutonium. So if you just have a nuclear power plant, you are not going to build a bomb. You need to have either enrichment or reprocessing. Those are the choke point technologies. Lots of countries have nuclear programs. Fewer countries, far fewer, have either enrichment or reprocessing. So, you know, like the UAE has signed a nuclear agreement with the U.S. Well, the UAE may build a power plant, but they're not going to. They've agreed in this agreement not to have enrichment or reprocessing. So they cannot get into the weapons game. So I think it's something that bears watching. But like, you know, the boy who cries wolf, I've heard wolf cried a lot. Many, 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 many times. So I want to see something, you know, before I start running for the hills or getting all upset about it. Yes, sir.
I'm Logan, and I'm trying not to get this right. So I guess considering the fact that, like, right now the two big frameworks for, like, for stopping states from pursuing their programs related to the PSI and the NPT, since neither of those really stop any state from dismantling their weapon systems, they don't, like, that's what I guess where a lot of the critique regarding teeth comes from. And you also said earlier that states rarely choose a policy that will ensure their death, which is, I can imagine, like a nuclear state going to war with a non-nuclear state, where the non-nuclear state would more than likely be at a disadvantage. Don't you think that, like, there's just, like, an inherent danger in protecting this nuclear inequality? Because right now, as it stands, it seems as if we just have the nuclear club, which is, I guess we're not being politically correct, taking a dump on the rest of the world, saying that, you know, they're not allowed to have nuclear weapons.
Yeah. Well, I can just give you my personal opinion about that, as opposed to, you know, evidence-based scholarly conclusion. I believe in the NPT. I believe in Article 6. Article 6 requires that all the nuclear weapon states bargain in good faith to give up their weapons. And I think every state member should follow that obligation. Now, and they should do it as a matter of urgency, not as a lip service to a infinite future that will never arrive. And the International Court of Justice agrees with me. They say that the governments of that have signed that treaty are legally obliged to be acting towards that goal. Now, do I think we should all give up our nuclear weapons tomorrow? No, I think that would be highly destabilizing. You know, we don't want South Korea to freak out because we go to zero tomorrow and they feel that their great protector in the alliance system has now walked away from them. Now, again, the U.S. military is still the largest military in the world, larger than the next 10 or 15 combined, and all of them are our friends. Right? But let's say that wasn't enough. What you want to do on this stuff is you want to ease people into things so that they can make mental adjustments. You don't want shocks, you know, shocks to the system. So I'm in favor of us having a plan, setting some benchmarks, being able to demonstrate to the rest of the world that we are meeting our obligations, and that over some period of time, is it 10 years, is it 20 years, but there's some time where we are, and then you can imagine it in different phases too, you know, so you get down to 100 or 200 weapons, and then you have some sort of thing where, well, maybe they are sort of held in escrow, where you begin to erect more barriers between possession and usage. And then people get used to that for a while, right? You know, another 5 years of that or 10 years of that. And then the idea of actually going from something that you're never using anyway that's already on the side that no one even talks about anymore, and going ahead and getting down to smaller and smaller, or maybe internationally owned or whatever, then I think that's doable.
So there could be zero.
I think there could be functional zero. Functional zero. Yes, ma'am.
I'm Alexa. I'm a sophomore. What you were saying before about Israel and Iraq really kind of caught my attention. And I know we said that we're not PC in this class, so the risk of sounding really blunt, I'm just curious as to whether you think that Iraq's WMDs were justification not only for us going to war with them to protect ourselves, but to protect the safety of the surrounding countries.
I think, you know, my reading of it, it's been some years since I've gone back and looked at it closely, but the last time I looked at it, my conclusion was we were going to war against Saddam Hussein regardless, and we had decided that a long time ago, and we were shopping for a rationale. And if WMD was the rationale and it worked, awesome. And if it didn't, human rights. And if that didn't work, but we were going to find a rationale, and we were going to go and attack them. But I think it was not unreasonable to suspect that he might have a residual program in chem and bio. IAEA pretty much dismantled everything he had. Now, he may have had a desire to get back in the game, but that, you know, desire in the nuclear world doesn't really count for a lot. You know, even wanting a capability doesn't count as much as you would think it would. So I never thought he had any nuclear assets or nuclear weapons, and I said so consistently on television at the time. And I, you know, and no one listened. But I thought it was possible that he had some leftover chem and bio stuff, but nothing that was, you know, really worth going to war over. Does that answer your question? Okay. Yes, sir.
Hi, Asad. Let's go to like a hypothetical like future world where everyone doesn't have nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
But there's still the problem of the fact that the knowledge of making a nuclear weapon still exists.
Sure.
So won't that like have awkward like states will still fear the fact that other states like some like really random state might get a nuclear weapon where no one else does. So
yeah.
Won't that stop like this whole thing from?
You know, I think that is a theoretical thing that is not true in practice. You know, I guess I could build a TV set because I know how to. You know, I can read a diagram, I don't know if I really could build a TV set, and maybe I could, you know, it's sort of, it's an argument that's, if everyone still has the knowledge to do it, then everyone should be in the position to be able to respond if someone does it, right, unless they're just going to build so what's the scenario here? There's some country and they build one really quick, and then they nuke someone.
Like the fear of that. Idea or that scenario.
Yeah. I mean, there's no, and in this world, there are no absolutes, right? This is, there's no absolute safety. There are no, there are risks attendant with everything. So it's about weighing the risks. I just find these arguments to be almost philosophical in the from my old philosophy days in the sense of, well, imagine that, la, 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 la. Well, yes, we could imagine that, but it doesn't seem like that's the way the world works. Particularly, now, if chem and bio stuff, I think is, or chem is not really a big deal, but bio stuff, I could see that being a bigger argument if it wasn't for the, and less so in nuclear, because again, you need enrichment and reprocessing. You cannot build a nuclear weapon unless you have one of those two things. And the whole, as I talked about the regime being dynamic, asymmetric, and enmeshing, that's only moving in one direction, which is more transparency about nuclear activities. And I just think it's, you know, so as a policy proposition, are we saying we're willing to accept the risk inherent in countries having nuclear weapons because we're afraid of the 1% scenario, the cost of the 1% scenario, the scenario that seems less likely, you know, which is the greater danger? To me, it's obviously more dangerous to have lots of weapons around that can be used, then worry about scenarios that might happen that seem really low probability, but which would be associated with potential costs. But I mean, let's say there's some country, right? Let's say it's North Korea, and North Korea.
Or how about like a developed country in the future, yeah. Like okay. Germany? No, Germany has. Does it?
No, Germany doesn't.
So like, supposing Germany became a really bad country like 30 years down the
road. Yeah.
And no one else had nuclear weapons.
What would it make you say that? No, okay.
And no one else had nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
Like there came a time where everyone decided like not to build nuclear weapons.
Yeah.
But then, the time where everyone's like, should we get rid of nuclear weapons?
Yeah.
Won't this idea of like, or someone could just like build one instantaneously that the resources.
And then they would do what?
Well, won't that cause imbalance in the power structure of?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I don't know what that means, cause imbalance in the power structure.
Like,
the you know, you'd have to take the weapon and translate it into a material outcome. You know, would they use it against someone? Would they threaten to use it against someone? What would they get in return for doing that? And I, you know, should be reminded, you know, with our $600 billion military, we have conventional weapons that are unfortunately nuclear equivalent in, you know, in their ability to crater places. So I don't think someone's going to build one nuclear weapon because that's going to be a risky one. They better get it right and they better succeed and their plan better work or they are fucked, right? So they have a lot of things that they're engaged in a high risk strategy that they better have high certainty for and they better be 100% certain it's not going to leak out and someone's going to find out about it. And then they got to hope that the U.S. response isn't to level them. Right? So I don't know. Maybe that would happen, but it just seems that you know, again, I want to emphasize, the policy proposition here is not about, well, we'll only do this if we can be guaranteed up front 100% that there's no scenario in which anything might go wrong. Well, if that's your standard, you're never going to do anything. You'll never do anything in life. The real question is, across a set of costs and benefits, when there are costs and benefits to pursuing that route and costs and benefits to not pursuing that route, over the greatest number of cases, what's most likely to yield the best result? So I think these things, scenarios, I'm not attacking your scenario at all. I know it seemed that way. I hope that didn't come across that way. I think these are conversations worth having, in part because people sort of throw stuff out and then it forces us to define more precisely, well, what is it about those events? How would that actually work out? And we should also, to be fair to you, we should also say, well, there are some things that we can't imagine, you know, we are surprised. There is such a thing as surprise in international politics. And there may be twists and turns that we can't now imagine, and it's worth having that conversation. But I can't emphasize enough that you have that conversation in the context of weighing the costs and benefits across the range of options and not making it, we'll only do X if it's 100% great and without risk or danger. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, my name is Yamila, and I'm a senior here, and I'm really interested in Egypt. And I know you've
awesome.
A good deal about Egypt, so I was wondering if you think that the 2011 presidential elections have any nuclear implications.
Well, I have a new book chapter out and a new book that was just published by Stanford University Press on the future of Egypt's nuclear potential nuclear ambitions. You know, I think it's unlikely. I mean, I worry about that transition for lots of reasons. I worry about it. I'd say nuclear ranks much further down the list of why I'm concerned about that transition in Egypt. But if you send me an email, I'll just send you the chapter.
Okay.
How's that?
Sounds good.
we got a negative response from Al Barade. We invited him to the workshop and to the symposium, but he's, you know, seriously still engaged
in running for
the president.
Yeah, I don't think he has a prayer, but.
No, it's like Ashraf Ghani in Afghanistan.
Yeah. Now, how long are we going to go for? Till 5:30 or?
5:25.
Okay, already.
And then we got Zach for 5 minutes and some wrap up. Is that good, Jim? Are you
That's
right?
good. I was wondering if
back,
I...
You know,
yeah, I know because I can't say no.
Yeah.
I was wondering, would it be possible for me to take a quick 3-minute break?
Yes, exactly.
Would that be okay?
Yes.
And then I'll be back in 3 minutes.
Sir.
Thank you.
And where's the instrument?
No.
That'll give you time to think more
damage.
Can you pass these out, guys?
I don't know, you grab that stuff.
I grab stuff, man. One of the things that you're going to have to get used to when we told you that we weren't going to be nonlinear, I mean, you know, we weren't going to be linear. So, every once in a while, and perhaps with frequency, we're going to throw curveballs at you just because we don't think you're only interested in nuclear issues, but the Institute is a large and happy, complex place. So we're going to, on occasion, alert you to other things that are happening that might have impact on your thinking and on your actions. I'm just passing you out a very quick thing that describes in very thumbnail scale the gentleman in front of you who we're very honored to have with us. Zach is going to be one of the leaders together with Rana Abdul Aziz, if anyone of you is taking Arabic. Rana is the head of the Arabic language program and a former Institute student. Rana and Zach are going to be two of the professional adult leaders. Adult's a lousy word. Two of the leaders together with the student leaders to our NIMEP trip to Kurdistan. But he has also something in mind. The reason he's come here when Jim is here is because part of it has to do with Iran. And if you can just give a sense of who you are, I mean, this, you know, and just what it is that you're envisioning.
Okay, great. Yeah, first off, nice to meet you all. Thank you for having me here today. I served in Iraq. I was a Marine officer. I did a number of tours there. I went back there a couple times for a film that I've directed and produced. And one of the things that I'm sort of interested in is, so all of you are undergrads?
Yes.
Is that right? So you guys grew up in a very different world than I grew up in. For you guys, probably the seminal moment of your lives, you know, in your childhood was probably 9/11, right? That was, you know, most of you were 12, 13, 14 years old at that time. So for me, the seminal moment was the fall of the Berlin Wall. That's, you know, sort of, that was a moment that was sort of the epic moment of my childhood. And then I grew up in the 90s, which is sort of this moment of American power, and, you know, we were unilateral superpower. There was great optimism about America's role in the world. And so it's sort of very different than probably my experience post the fall of the Berlin Wall, your experience in seeing American foreign policy post 9/11. And one of the things that I've become very interested in since I've left the Marine Corps is exploring alternative methods or mechanisms of foreign policy. And so one of those is there a way to explore grassroots diplomacy? So there's countries out there in the world right now that we don't talk to. You know, for example, Iran is one of them. And I'm really interested in exploring whether we can take a group of students here and pair them with students over there to talk about some of these issues that our governments are unable to discuss and possibly provide a model for engagement. And so that's a program that I'm going to be putting together over the next semester, and I hope that you guys will all participate in that as well. And then on top of that, I'm also leading this trip to Kurdistan, so I hope to see you guys also there.
Is there, we are at an interesting time. I'm not sure, I mean, I think I'm quite sure I am using hyperbole here when I liken what I'm about to say to the McCarthy period of the 50s. But there's something going on in this country, even under this administration and the Supreme Court, where talking to the enemy is now punishable by potential imprisonment, right? I'm not exaggerating this. I'm wondering where the hell this is going. By that standard, a lot of my former students and friends would be imprisoned at this point. NIMEP, which is the new initiative for Middle East peace, which is going to Kurdistan this year, has been in Syria, where we've met with Mashal. We've been in Lebanon, where we've met with Fadlallah. I'm not sure who we met with when we went to Iran initially in 2004. We were the only student group that actually was invited in by the government to Qom and then to the School of International Relations. But there's a proscription now about this kind of contact at a time when we had the optimism about the potential of the Obama administration lifting academic travel restrictions to Cuba, and we had other sorts of visions and fantasies. I'm hoping there are not fantasies, and we're trying to still be in the framework of what we did last year with Ambassador Lures, who's good friends with Jim and involved in this Iran initiative, where he, as the former ambassador to the Czech Republic, the former head of the United Nations Association, ambassador to, where else? Colombia,
Venezuela.
You know, ran a seminar, which was very well received here, on talking to the enemy. We began a program called Salia here, which is now at the United Nations, which is was a early crude see you, see me type of camera computer dialogue around the time that Arafat was dying. And we had Egyptians and Israelis and Jordanians and Palestinians and Americans talking to one another about what was going on. We have a strong interest in this type of grassroots stuff. I mean, the MX missile stuff, which you'll learn about via me, et cetera, was a citizens' action initiative. We have a strong concern at this university and certainly at the Institute in this type of enterprise. So what I'm going to do is pair you up. I mean, you guys are going to talk to one another. You already have. But I'm very interested in our ability to get into North Korea. And we found this program that's worked already with Princeton students and others in a dialogue between South and North Korea and sending students back and forth. One of our former students is Chung Min Lee, who's was my first teaching assistant, like you guys, in 95, 86. So there are things that are going to percolate in this class that have to do with this kind of overture outreach, which we're hoping that you guys would be prepared for and prepared to engage in, if we can do it. Some of the things are legal at this particular point. We don't know. But Zach is really an ideal person to think about us with this, and Rana. And we have a little antecedent history. And one of the questions I'm going to ask, and then I'm going to cede this back to Jim, who was in the picture from North Korea? Can you help us get into North Korea?
Possible. You know, right now, everything's on a freeze right now because of the North Koreans sank a South Korean ship last spring, the Chenon. And so everything's been in the deep freeze. Now, I expect the six-party talks to resume soon. And
Ambassador Bosworth at our university, the dean of the Fletcher School, will be with you on October 5th, and he's one of the people involved in this.
He's one of the main people. He's the U.S. envoy to North Korea.
Right.
So I think once the 6:40 talks resume, it will be easier to think about that as a proposition. There are, I mean, they sent, I was with them in Sweden. There's a set of my colleagues who are going to visit next week, or next week. But it's still a tentative time. And when they're talking, they're much easier to go and visit. You know, when they're not talking, or when things are not good, your visits don't happen.
Yes?
Do we have a good relationship with Jimmy Carter or Bill Clinton? Will he go there and pick us out if we have any trouble?
Yeah, we do.
Excellent.
As a matter of fact.
It's all good.
It's all good, yeah.
Do you mind if I throw a question?
Yes, please, go ahead. I don't mind.
Now that I've been introduced, I don't have to say my name.
Yes, you do.
Zach Iskel from New York. Something that I'm sort of curious about is, in terms of the acquisition of nuclear weapons, is there any evidence that relations between countries improve when they become nuclear powers, either Israel and its neighbors, Pakistan?
There is an argument for, this is good because it comes back to this other thing about all things have costs and benefits. And so a deterrent relationship that is crisp and clearly communicated can induce caution on the part of the states. So, for the most part, not entirely, but for the most part, the U.S. and the Soviet Union were more cautious around the edges. They didn't engage in direct fighting with each other. They used proxies because they didn't want to set off a nuclear war. Now, of course, when it comes to nuclear weapons, the exceptions matter. So, because if you screw up once, it's still really big. So the Cuban Missile Crisis, not so good. Not such a good track record there. But, and some have argued, there are scholars who argue that the Pakistan's acquisition of nuclear weapons has brought some deterrent stability to the India-Pakistan relationship. Now that, that's disputed, and we're certainly in the first inning of a 9-inning game, but there's some sense of that. So I guess the way I think about it is that deterrence has benefits, and it has costs, just like the absence of nuclear weapons has benefits and it has costs. So I think one of the good things about deterrence is that it does sort of discourage large-scale interstate war, conventional large-scale interstate war. And as long as that works, it's awesome. The problem is nothing lasts forever. There is no perfection on Earth. And so eventually you play that game and you lose. And so then you're weighing lower incidence of large-scale conventional war versus, nuclear, suicide between two weapon states. I don't think we're ever going to get to the point like we did during the Cold War where everyone has, 50,000 nuclear warheads, where you could really threaten the life of the planet. I mean, if the U.S. and the Soviet Union had gone at each other, that would have been the end of the planet. That would have been our war that we would have imposed on the planet. Now, I don't think the arsenals in competing states, Israel, pick a, someone who might be a nuclear weapon state in the future, or India, Pakistan, I don't think they're going to build 50,000 nuclear warheads, and I don't think they're going to fire 50,000 nuclear warheads. But if they fire two, and they take out, Delhi and Karachi or something, that is millions of people. That's in the first day, right? Because then there's the whole infrastructure collapse and everything that follows from that. So, it's a Hobbesian choice here. Some benefit from the nuclear weapons, risk from the nuclear weapons. But at the end of the day, I come down saying the nuclear weapons are more dangerous than you can afford.
A different gender.
Yeah.
I mean, I think you're male.
Yes, ma'am. That's right. You had raised your hand before.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
What's the dialogue?
Yeah. Well, I'm glad you said that because, first of all, that's, a giant chunk of the world. And also, Latin America has had its own nuclear weapons history. And looking forward, Brazil is a country of concern. Brazil and Argentina, remember, they had military governments during large periods of their history. And there's strong evidence to suggest that they were running clandestine bomb programs. Now,
Eventually, those countries democratized and they gave up their bomb programs. And what the causal relationship between those two things is still debated among scholars. Was, you know, did one cause the other? Did one precede the other? But it invokes issues of status that they, you know, almost more than security, that Brazil thought it was a great power and wasn't being recognized as a great power and was the hemispheric, or, you know, dominant player, is the largest country in South America, biggest population. And so, and then Argentina feels that way too, plus they probably, you know, I don't know. I'm not a specialist in those cases, my friends who are, but they may have also reacted to the security notion that Brazil might be interested in nuclear weapons. But in any case, these were military governments that didn't like each other. Going forward, the concern is that Brazil is getting into the enrichment game. And remember, I said you only get nuclear weapons if you have enrichment or reprocessing. And they are getting in, and they're in the enrichment game. And so, they're not proactively forthcoming and as transparent as they might be. You know, have more confidence about a country's nuclear program when they are affirmatively. They don't just comply with the letter of the law, but they are affirmatively transparent. You know, they go the extra mile to let people look at what they want to look at, and you know, all doors open. Well, Brazil has traditionally not handled it that way. And that makes people nervous. And then in Africa, obviously South Africa is the dominant country. It was the dominant country with in terms of having produced nuclear weapons, a dominant economy. Egypt is on the African continent. They flirted with nuclear weapons, but I feel pretty confident in saying that they're not going to go down that route. There were rumors that Nigeria was interested in nuclear weapons. But, you know, that's just a rumor. They were on the bottom of that slide of possible countries to investigate. And, of course, there's naturally a third world or a developing world critique that was really resonant in the 1970s about domination of European states with nuclear weapons. And, in fact, you'll remember China in the 60s, their view was this was colonialism. You know, people talk about the rogue state. There is no rogue state roguier than China under Mao. That was the defining rogue state, and I doubt anyone's ever going to beat them, because their deal was, you know, screw the West and Russia, and we're going to make nuclear weapons, and we're going to give them to our friends. Take that. And, oh, by the way, we're going to be the only country in the history of the world to detonate a live nuclear weapon over our territory, where it's launched here and lands there. Yeah, that didn't seem like a good idea, but... you know, so they were, that not only were they saying, you know, and they weren't a member of the UN, right, during this period, and there was talk about, to invoke the old days, what was the axis of evil? The axis of evil in that period in the 1960s was, it was called the Beijing, or again, they didn't say Beijing then, it was the Peking, Pyongyang, Jakarta axis. It was Indonesia, which was being ruled by Suharto, I guess. And North Korea and China, and they were, you know, the states giving the West the finger and saying, we're gonna all get nuclear weapons, and we'll show you guys. So that's been a strong critique, but that has, and India held on to that critique, I think, and to justify its acquisition of nuclear weapons. But I think the narrative has changed, and so the narrative is that the nuclear weapon states need to give up their nuclear weapons. Not that everyone should get one. I'm going to take, because I'm afraid we're going to run out of time, so I'm going to take questions in bunches, and that'll force me to give crisper answers. So if you think that you might want to ask a question over the next 7 minutes, raise your hand now so I can see you. Okay. All right, well, we can do that. All right. And they're all men. I'm going to have to skip you because
we have fungible time. It's just I want to respect your time.
Yeah, I don't have fungible time.
That's what I wanted to understand.
Yeah. Okay. Let's get several. Let's get them in units of two.
Tight questions.
Okay. Flabby answers.
You are.
Okay.
You are.
All right. Tight question.
You got to say who you are.
Sorry. My name's Dan, and I'm a junior. You had mentioned that the NPT was both dynamic and enmeshing, and that has led only to more transparency. My question, I guess, is there a limit to the amount that it can be dynamic without it becoming compromised or trivialized?
Uh-huh. Okay, good.
Could you
elaborate?
You are.
Hi, Seth. The sophomore. Could you elaborate a bit on how you expect North Korea's foreign policy to change with the changing of the leadership?
All right. Both good questions. On the first one, I think, again, reasoning from the past, you know, that sometimes that's wrong. You know, when you watch the investment ads, they say the past is no necessary predictor of the future. Boy, didn't that turn out to be true. And but I think that it seems so unidirectional that they grow, that they've never gotten weaker. They've only gotten stronger. And they've only increased the instrumentalities that are available to them. So now before you could only look in the building and the room they let you to look at. Now you can look in the whole building and you can swipe stuff and go back to the lab and measure it. And you can look around at sites that are undeclared. That's why we didn't find Saddam sites, because they were undeclared. Crisis with Saddam, response, community freaks, they write new rules that are more intrusive. So I think that dialectic of people are gonna make, you know, they're gonna be crises, people are going to find some low-level cheating, and the response will be, oh, we got to fix that loophole. So I think it's going to be only stronger, only better, and I think the technical means are only going to improve. You know, satellites, we're just going to know a lot more about what's going on in these countries. North Korea after the transition. Well, you know, I think mostly it's going to be bad. You know, I'm not predicting that, but if I count the number of scenarios and the number of good scenarios versus the number of bad scenarios, good or the same seems less frequent in that array. Why do I say that? Well, one, they could go through the transition and collapse at the same time. That's not good. Collapse when they had a firm government, not good. Collapse during a period of transition, worse.
What would a collapse look like there? Would it be run?
Everyone would run for the borders. No, there wouldn't be war. It would just be people would defect in droves. And then that would cause all sorts of difficult decisions to have to be made. Like, do we wall them in? Do we take troops and rush to Pyongyang as China rushes troops south? What happens to the nuclear material? And all these starving guys? So that will be an unpleasant thing should it happen. But so we've got the transition. The guy's not ready to rule. He's 20 years old. He doesn't know anything. Nothing personal. And Kim has assigned his father-in-law to as a sort of a regent, you know, back to the monarchical days, where he's supposed to manage things until the son grows into the job. Well, you know, maybe he'll like that job and not want to give it up. Or maybe the military, in a society whose slogan is military first, that was an innovation that Kim Jong-il introduced, may decide, well, maybe we should really make the military first. Maybe we should decide. In which case, I think that would have big complications for the future of the nuclear program. Maybe there are other people on the National Defense Commission who think they've waited long enough and they deserve a shot. And that the son-in-law guy, who's no spring chicken, by the way, and could die, maybe they ought to be running things. And then, you know, so then you've got uncertainty, you've got competition for power, then how does one person prove that they're a better, you know, more deserving? Well, if we're in the context of a negative relationship with them, maybe one way they prove they're better, a better leader is to do nasty stuff, you know, to show that they're the one who should really be doing stuff. They're the one in charge. Remember, when Kim, think back to early 1990s, we are on the verge of bombing North Korea in 1993. Clinton is going to bomb North Korea. I thought it was a terrible idea, but he somehow got talked into it. So Jimmy Carter visits, right, much earlier on. And this really pisses Clinton off. But he walks out with an agreement on the eve of this that prevents military attack on North Korea. And some people are, you know, but they have to go along with it. What happens? You know, less than a year later, Kim Il-sung dies of a heart attack. No one saw that coming. So imagine if Carter had not intervened. And we had attacked those facilities, and then Kim Il-sung had died. Right then, the whole nature of the relationship would have been different. Instead, Carter intervenes, and Kim Il-sung signs an agreement, the agreed framework. And so when he dies, what Kim Jong-il, his son, comes out and says, I'm going to follow the legacy of my father and continue with this agreement and continue down the road of U.S.-North Korean relations. So right now, we do not have a good context. So if things go south quickly, there's no one to say, oh, let's follow the positive legacy of my father and do all these other things. What you haven't said is tremendous uncertainty. And, you know, one of the reasons I worry about the Iran thing, not that I worry that they're going to have a nuclear weapon tomorrow, they're not. Those timelines are all messed up. But I just think states under, again, I'm an internal politics guy, that's my bias. I think states that are undergoing internal competition for power, they're very hard to negotiate with because there's not one person across the table. There's not a unified government. And there are perverse incentives. So we see this in Iran. So Iran, so it's Ahmadinejad who wants to have a better relationship with the U.S. right now. He said, we'll come back to the P5 plus one talks. And I'm guessing he's the guy who was trying to get the thing arranged to get the hiker released. In fact, when I had dinner with him, you know, in that group last year, he said they were going to release the hikers, and he said he wanted the hikers released. But you know that, I mean, I'm guessing that they made that arrangement, and then his political enemies, also conservatives, said, you know, no, we're not, you know, we're shutting you down. And so it becomes very difficult to make progress when the two sides are fighting each other and you're sort of a pawn caught in the middle of that. That it's not about the U.S. policy, it's about the fight for power inside Iran. And so I would be afraid of that dynamic in North Korea.
Would it be possible that one of the sides that are engaged in fighting would choose to ally with the United States in anticipation of a collapse and then see the United States as a potential international support?
It could be, but what a high-risk maneuver that is, because if it was found out, you'd be instantly discredited. Right, that would be called foreign intervention. That would be, you know, playing in the internal affairs of another state, which is the exact thing we don't want the North Koreans to think. We don't want them to feel threatened as they go through this. We want to send a loud and clear message to them: this is your business. We don't want to have anything to do with it. You guys go take care of your stuff, and we'll continue working on our nuclear thing. But we are hands off. I think that's the safer way to go. All right, two more questions.
Ooh.
Oh, we used to. All right, let's hear him. Let's hear the damn questions.
Yeah.
Just to keep you, this is a little bit off topic.
You are.
I'm Roy. I'm a freshman. Sorry. I think I was wondering about security of nuclear power plants. And
yeah.
Potential for
yeah.
a dirty bomb that wasn't necessarily like fully nuclear
yeah.
capable.
Okay.
It seems a little bit more plausible.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, got it. And then was there one other question? Yes, ma'am. Yeah, okay. Okay, on new power plants and radiological weapons. Nuclear power plants are built, I'm not a huge fan of nuclear power, but like anything else, it's got costs and benefits like all the other power choices. But they're built to withstand earthquakes, and, you know, they're not, the nuclear industry has not spent a lot of time worrying about attacks on nuclear power plants, and that's too bad. But they're pretty robust. They're pretty robust as structures go. So, and that movie I was in was based on a scenario of terrorists taking over a nuclear power plant. So I think it's a concern, but it's not at the top of my list. Radiological weapons, big psychological and political impact, very, very minor health impact. Because, you know, it's not, there's more people will die from the blast, the conventional blast, than will die from the exposure to the radiation. Because what, you know, you can get up and move over one block, and then you're not exposed anymore. But people might freak at it, right? And so, and we're not prepared to deal with it very well, I don't think. So there's the sort of add-on cost of you screw it up when you're dealing with it, and then, you know, things like that. But so I think that's a fixable problem. So I like the idea of spending some effort on the radiological dirty bomb issue, because I think that's something you can easily do something about, and you can minimize the consequences. And I'm not sure we're quite there yet. Bioweapons, I'm not a bioweapon guy, I don't know. But I would say what I said before, which is it doesn't seem to have the same advantage of having a technological choke point. There's nothing I see in the biological world that's the equivalent of you either have to have reprocessing or enrichment or you don't get a bomb, which is really helpful in stopping the nuclear weapons. I don't see that on the biological side, but I'm not a bio person. I'm heartened by the fact that, frankly, this stuff just does not happen very often. Right? We all freak about it. I understand that. But as an empirical matter, it rarely, rarely happens. So I take some solace from that. But it seems like that's an awfully dynamic field. and things could change rapidly in 10 or 20 years. And so I'll leave that to my friends who work on it rather than make statements that aren't true. I've done enough of that already.
Jim Walsh.
You did it again, didn't you? To the horizon.